The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the August 22nd, 2014 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. The U.S. enters the battle against ISIS. What happened? U.S. Special Forces troops this week joined efforts on the ground to help 30,000 Yazidi refugees escape the Islamist fighters in Iraq, as American fighter jets and drones launched the first airstrikes there since the U.S. withdrew its forces in 2011. President Obama authorized the strikes to prevent an act of genocide after fighters for the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, seized several towns in northern Iraq, forcing Kurdistan's Peshmerga forces into retreat, and laid siege to tens of thousands of fleeing Yazidis trapped in their Sinjar Mountains with no food or water. The Yazidis, a small religious sect, were ordered by ISIS to convert to its extremist form of Sunni Islam or die. U.S. officials insisted that the Special Forces' efforts to create a humanitarian corridor for the Yazidis to escape into Kurdistan were not the start of a boots-on-the-ground operation, and that American involvement would remain limited. The U.S. and Western allies were also sending shipments of heavy arms to the Peshmerga to aid its defense of Kurdish territory from ISIS's rampaging forces. In Baghdad, the reign of Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki appeared to be ending as Iraq's new president nominated one of his Shiite rivals, Haider al-Abadi, to be Iraq's next prime minister. Al-Maliki initially was defiant, but when the military, his own party, and Iran's government told him he no longer had their support, al-Maliki pledged not to use force to remain in power. The U.S. has long blamed al-Maliki, a Shiite, for stoking the sectarian divides tearing apart the country. He is now expected to negotiate some sort of immunity deal in exchange for a smooth transfer of power. What the editorial said: these airstrikes need not and should not signal a re-escalation of the Iraq War, said the Boston Globe. Obama has clearly limited his objectives to averting a potential genocide and protecting America's long-term allies, the Kurds. The Obama administration seems fixated on securing some grand political solution in Baghdad, said the Wall Street Journal. But like it or not, we are at war again in Iraq. And until the jihadist threat is defeated, a new prime minister cannot restore order to the country. Limited airstrikes certainly won't stop this jihadist army. We need to supply whatever heavy arms the Kurds need, and also to assist Iraq's military in retaking territory ISIS now controls. A military solution is essential to any political solution. What the columnist said: clearly, there is a risk that America will be sucked back into Iraq, said Peter Beinart in TheAtlantic.com. But everything we know about Barack Obama suggests he will resist that fiercely. And so will Americans. And because we broke Iraq, the U.S. has a moral responsibility to save the Yazidis from genocide. Mission creep is a risk we'll just have to take. ISIS isn't as invincible as its weaponry and territorial gains have made it seem, said Michael Pregent and Michael Weiss in the Wall Street Journal. Although militants have stolen a lot of American armor from the Iraqi army, including 30 working M1 Abrams tanks and howitzers, they don't have the maintenance know-how and parts to keep them running. Soon these weapons will break down. They also have no ground-to-air missile capable of taking down fighter jets, and their supply lines from Sinjar to Mosul are wide open to airstrikes. ISIS is a formidable enemy, but with a concerted effort, it can be rolled back. But in the long term, defeating ISIS is the Iraqi government's job, said Zayed al-Ali in the New York Times. For that to happen, Iraqi politicians need to regain the trust of our population. They must bring Sunnis and Kurds into the army and other national institutions and publicly hold to account those who abused their power during al-Maliki's reign. To prevent future abuses, power over the military and police must be transferred to a civilian-led national council. If the existential threat from ISIS isn't enough to shake the political class into acting, nothing will. Excuse me. And a second main story. Racial tensions explode in St. Louis. What happened? The FBI this week opened an investigation into the fatal shooting of an unarmed black teenager by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, as angry protesters clashed with heavily armed riot police in the St. Louis suburb over the racially charged killing. Michael Brown, 18, was shot multiple times during a confrontation with a still unnamed police officer in the mostly black community last weekend. Eyewitnesses said that a white police officer pulled up beside Brown and a friend as they were walking down the street and ordered them to move to the sidewalk. When the 6'4" Brown objected, he was told to get into the police car. Police said Brown scuffled with the officer and attempted to grab his gun. A shot was fired inside the car, and Brown was shot multiple times, about 35 feet from the vehicle. Several witnesses said the teen was shot while backing away with his hands in the air. The FBI probe will look into possible civil rights violations. St. Louis County Police are also investigating the shooting. Businesses were looted and stores set on fire as demonstrations in Ferguson turned violent, and local SWAT teams used tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse protesters. President Obama joined Brown's family in calling for calm, saying that members of the community should comfort one another in a way that heals, not in a way that wounds. What the editorial said, "The events leading up to Brown's tragic death are still in dispute," said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. "But it's clear that local police completely mishandled their response to this shooting. By refusing to release the officer's name, they have violated the very principle of transparency recommended by law enforcement officials and fueled suspicions that authorities are trying to stage a cover-up. Heavy-handed policing has only made a bad situation worse," said the Kansas City Star. "Patrolling in armored vehicles, armed with military-style rifles and tear gas, St. Louis's SWAT teams have ramped up tensions with residents. One officer was caught on video telling protesters, 'Bring it, all you blanking animals.'" Racial tension between public officials and residents runs deep in St. Louis, said the New York Times. "The city has long been one of the nation's most segregated areas, and its majority black community is still woefully underrepresented in local government. Take Ferguson itself. Only 3 of its 53 police officers are black, while its mayor and police chief are white. With such a toxic racial legacy, it's just a surprise that it took St. Louis this long to explode." What the columnist said, The injury, a deadly one, came first, said James Poniewicz in Time.com. Then came the insult. A photo of Brown, who was 2 days away from starting college, supposedly flashing gang signs. As conservatives did with Trayvon Martin, they seized on that image to call Brown a thug. That sparked a national Twitter campaign. Hashtag if they gunned me down, in which young blacks displayed two photos of themselves, one in a menacing pose and the other showing them at their college graduation or hugging their mothers. The point is that white people always see the worst in black men, said Jonathan Capehart in WashingtonPost.com. Growing up, I learned not to run in public or talk back to the police, lest I arouse undue suspicion. White people have no idea what it's like to live under that kind of siege. It's too early to view this killing through the twisted prism of race, said John Cass in the Chicago Tribune, especially because it's still not clear whether the police officer was acting in self-defense. Moreover, where's the outrage for the countless other young African-American men shot down every day in American cities, mostly by other black men? Black-on-black violence is a real problem, but it has nothing to do with the question at hand, said Charles Cook in NationalReview.com. There's a special horror when an armed government servant paid to protect citizens guns down an unarmed black teenager, especially in a country with a long history of racism. The question of who guards the guardians pertains now as keenly as it ever has. The answer should be, we do. But it wasn't all bad. Monet Davis is a superstar in the making. The 13-year-old pitcher from Philadelphia propelled her otherwise all-male Little League team, the Taney Dragons, to the Little League World Series this week with an 8-0 victory over Delaware's Newark National. Davis gave up just 3 hits and notched 6 strikeouts as her fastball hit 70 miles per hour through 6 scoreless innings. Only 18 girls have competed in the Little League World Series in its 68-year history. But Davis, who also plays basketball, is confident about her sporting future. I'll probably either be the first female in the MLB or in the NBA. And our controversy of the week. Back to Iraq. Has the Obama doctrine failed? An army of at least 10,000 heavily armed jihadists on the march. A regional Sunni-Shiite war and a radical Islamic State rising from the ashes of a broken Iraq and Syria. This, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post, is what the complete collapse of a foreign policy doctrine looks like. President Obama's decision last week to launch airstrikes in Iraq against the gathering forces of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria was a grim vindication for those who said withdrawing from Iraq was a mistake, and that Obama should have aided the anti-Assad rebels in Syria before the Islamists filled the vacuum there. Even now, Obama is still expressing ambivalence about intervening in the region and can articulate no clear policy goal. As one foreign affairs expert put it, great nations need organizing principles, and don't do stupid stuff is not an organizing principle, which neoconservative naysayer delivered this withering put down of the Obama doctrine, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. None other than Hillary Clinton, Obama's own former Secretary of State and his would-be successor. Clinton has her reasons, of course, for distancing herself from her unpopular former boss, but even liberals now can see the failures of Obama's worldview. The Middle East may be a mess, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, but let's remember who stirred up this cauldron of woe in the first place. George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. Their foolish and unwarranted invasion of Iraq in 2003 destabilized the entire region, triggered the Sunni-Shiite civil war that's still unfolding, and turned Iraq into a magnet for Islamist extremists. It's that fiasco that has made Obama so reluctant to swat the hornet's nest again. Perhaps the suddenly gleeful neocons haven't noticed, said Leslie Gilb in thedailybeast.com, but ISIS is marauding through central Iraq on M1 tanks and Humvees we originally gave to the good guys in Iraq. The Iraqi army simply ran away, abandoning its weapons when challenged by ISIS's fanatical warriors. The good rebel groups in Syria we supposedly should be supporting have been no less ineffective. Neocon critics like Senator John McCain never explain what they do differently from Obama, while continuing their heartfelt advocacy of the same stupid stuff that's already failed so miserably. Despite what Obama critics say, his foreign policy does have an organizing principle, said Carter Eskew in WashingtonPost.com. As he put it last week in an interview with the New York Times, we cannot do for other countries what they are unwilling to do for themselves. The U.S., he believes, can influence what happens abroad but not control it. That realistic assessment is tough to swallow for American exceptionalists still clinging to the fantasy that we can use military force to export freedom and democracy. But as Iraq and Afghanistan have proven, there is a lot of wisdom in Obama's skepticism. Indeed, there is, and Obama should ignore the hawks clamoring for intervention, said Daniel Larrison in theamericanservative.com. Let's remember that the U.S. has spent the last 23 years bombing, occupying, sanctioning, and otherwise interfering with Iraq. Until the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, the governments there and in Syria were secular, and radical Islamists had virtually no influence. All we've bought with lavish expenditures of blood and treasure is the current chaos. It was force, in other words, that made the mess. So why is more force now the solution? Well, it was a good week for self-defense after a 9-year-old fought off a giant alligator that bit him while he was swimming in a Florida lake. I just immediately hit it. And I let it go a little so I could pry its jaw open, said James Barney Jr., who had only minor cuts. It was a good week for adaptation after pro basketball player Meta World Peace, formerly known as Ron Artest, announced that he will go by a new name, the Panda's Friend, while playing this year for the Sichuan Blue Whales of the Chinese Basketball Association. It was a good week for mercy, after a toddler squeezed through the bars of the White House fence, triggering a lockdown. We were going to wait until he learned to talk to question the boy, said Secret Service spokesman Edwin Donovan. But in lieu of that, he got a timeout. It was a bad week for being a bad spirit, after a British man was arrested and fined $125 for frightening mourners in a cemetery by pretending to be a ghost. Prosecutors said Anthony Stollard, 24, was throwing himself backward, waving his arm and going, "Ooh." It was a bad week for unsafe sex after 6 Swiss tourists in Ibiza, Spain, were fined $135 each when they were caught having an orgy in a moving van. Having sex in the back seat back of a van is not illegal, said a police spokesman. Not wearing a seatbelt is. It was a bad week for flashing your gams after a Washington State woman allegedly assaulted a guest at a company picnic because her shorts were too short. Police said Alicia Hansen, 25, punched the woman, pulled her hair, and left a pile of blonde hair extensions on a table. turn now over to the briefing page. Misery on the Gaza Strip. It's been called an open-air prison, housing 1.8 million people. How did Gaza become such a humanitarian disaster? How bad is the new damage? It's catastrophic. In its military confrontation with Hamas, Israel destroyed more than 10,000 homes, leaving entire neighborhoods, leveling entire neighborhoods, and displaced nearly a quarter of Gaza's 1.8 million residents. Nearly 1,900 Palestinians were killed, including more than 400 children. Electricity is on only a few hours a day. Hospitals are overloaded, and bodies are still believed to be buried under the debris created by Israeli missile attacks. And Gaza was already a humanitarian disaster zone before the bombs started falling. Almost half the population relied on the UN for food aid. About 80% of the population was living in poverty, and 40% was unemployed. Before the conflict began, the people of Gaza were close to the breaking point, said Saleh Saeed, head of the British charity, the Disaster Emergency Committee. Now we are seeing a humanitarian emergency affecting virtually every man, woman, and child. Why was the situation so dire? In 2007, 2 years after Israel ended its decades-long occupation, the militant group Hamas seized control of the territory from its moderate rival Fatah in a brief but bloody civil war. Hamas doesn't recognize Israel's right to exist and is pledged to its destruction. So when it took power, it intensified the rocket attacks on Israeli towns and cities, and the Jewish state responded by imposing a blockade to keep missiles and other weapons out of Hamas's hands. The blockade banned the importation of everything from building materials to computers to basic foodstuffs. It also barred most experts, prohibited Gazan fishermen from going more than a few miles out to sea, and made it nearly impossible for Gazans to leave their territory. British Prime Minister David Cameron has famously called the Strip an open-air prison. Has the blockade worked? If the goal was to keep arms out of Hamas's hands, no. The blockage did destroy Gaza's economy. Exports are now less than 3% of what they were pre-blockade. But Hamas built a network of tunnels beneath the Egyptian border and smuggled in food, goods, building materials, and weapons. Egypt initially turned a blind eye to Hamas's activities, and when the pro-Hamas Muslim Brotherhood was ousted from power in Cairo last year, the new military regime destroyed the vast majority of the tunnels into Egypt. This served as Gaza's lifeline to the outside world. Food and fuel prices soared, and a shortage of building materials stopped work on 19 of the territory's 20 construction projects. Hamas now insists that any long-term peace deal is contingent on Israel's lifting its blockade. Is that likely to happen? It would require a diplomatic breakthrough. Israel is very reluctant to lift the blockade because Hamas used vast amounts of concrete and cement, materials supposedly imported for the rebuilding of schools and homes, to create a sophisticated network of tunnels under the Israeli border. Unlike the smuggling tunnels leading to Egypt, these were built for the sole purpose of attacking or kidnapping Israelis. In 2006, Hamas used one to abduct a soldier, Gilad Shalit, who was eventually exchanged for 1,027 Palestinian prisoners. In recent weeks, Israeli ground forces destroyed 32 terror tunnels, but they admit that some may remain. It's not a pleasant thought, said Eyal Brandeis, who lives a mile from where one of the tunnels was discovered, that you sit one day on the patio drinking coffee and a bunch of terrorists will rise from the ground. What would a peace deal require? First of all, both sides have to be so sick of conflict and vengeance that they're willing to gamble on trusting each other. Israel will not negotiate directly with Hamas, so any peace deal must involve Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. In April, Abbas announced a unity deal between his Fatah party, which dominates the ruling Palestinian Authority, in the West Bank, and Hamas. At the time, this incensed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, since Hamas is openly devoted to Israel's annihilation, and led to the failure of U.S. brokered peace talks. But now Netanyahu seems willing to deal with Abbas as a more responsible partner than Hamas. Israel's only alternative is endless war with Hamas and more bloody incursions. Will Hamas really negotiate? That remains to be seen. But it is clearly weakened. It lost hundreds of fighters, and its use of civilians as human shields has alienated much of the Arab world. Hamas's leaders have signaled willingness to allow the PA to manage Gaza's borders and oversee its reconstruction. Meanwhile, the high civilian death toll has put strong international pressure on Netanyahu to find a solution. Any long-term agreement would require major concessions on both sides. That's never happened in the past, and talks could easily break down. But the third Israeli-Hamas war in 6 years has created new desperation on both sides. Sometimes out of the blood, crisis, and catastrophe, said Fatah foreign policy advisor Hussam Zamlat, comes opportunity. We'll take a look at a few of the best columns now. First, from the U.S., conservatives aren't all wing nuts, says Kyle Smith from the New York Post. Loon, nut job, crank, wing nut, whack job, crackpot. Liberals use all these words as synonyms for conservative, apparently having decided that everyone on the right is mentally ill, said Kyle Smith. On the left-leaning Salon.com, virtually all conservatives are carelessly dismissed as wingnuts, including such mainstream figures as Chief Justice John Roberts, Senator Marco Rubio, and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Liberals like to boast about their superior powers of empathy, and yet they make no pretense whatsoever of understanding their ideological opposites. Or indeed, the American people, who for 16 of the last 20 years have elected a Congress designed to act as a stalwart check on progressivism. In fact, when social scientist Jonathan Haidt asked liberals and conservatives to guess how their ideological opponents would answer certain questions, he found that conservatives were much better at seeing things from the other guy's shoes. Liberals haven't a clue how conservatives think. Maybe they ought to try understanding principled conservative thought, rather than responding to our ideas and values with schoolyard insults. This column comes from France, from Marie Lemonnier, says why the Jews are leaving for Israel. French Jews would rather live in a war zone than France. It's why the Jews are leaving for Israel. French Jews would rather live in a war zone than France, said Marie Lemonnier. This year, more than 5,000 Jews are expected to leave the country for Israel, making France the largest source of migrants to Israel for the first time, ahead of even Russia or the U.S., which have larger Jewish communities. That's partly because of Israeli policy. The country is actively courting French Jews, 150,000 of whom have already made the move. But it's mostly because of French hostility. Many new immigrants say the wave of anti-Semitic attacks that accompanied recent pro-Palestinian demonstrations, as well as the sight of Hamas flags flying outside the Bastille, crystallized their choice to leave. Others began thinking of leaving 2 years ago, when a French Algerian gunned down a rabbi and three children at a Jewish school in Toulouse. The fighting in Gaza and the rockets lobbed by Hamas into Israeli territory this summer do not deter them. We are much better protected here by the Israeli Defense Forces, said Sabine, a pharmacist who moved to the Jewish state with her family from a Parisian suburb. They don't speak Hebrew, and they're not religiously observant, yet they feel more welcome in Israel than in the France of their birth. And from Pakistan, Babar Sattar, can tribes be turned from terror? Demolishing the terrorist infrastructure in Pakistan's tribal areas is only half the job, said Babar Sattar. Winning over the local people so they don't revert to Taliban control is the other half. The army has blazed through North Waziristan over the past few months, destroying explosives factories, confiscating troves of cash, and breaking up schools that churn out our brainwashed suicide bombers. Obviously, such a vast Taliban supply network could not have existed without local acquiescence. But we can't simply brand tribals as abettors or terrorists and wash our hands of them. The Pakistani state failed these people by letting them fall under the sway of the Taliban. Now that the army has displaced more than 800,000 tribespeople, we can't fail them again. De-radicalization programs must start immediately. The tribal areas need new governance that combines tribal representation and autonomy with citizen responsibility to the state. For example, with lower courts headed by elders whose rulings can be appealed in federal higher courts. Most importantly, the Afghan border must be fenced and policed. All this will cost money, but the tribespeople can't be expected to reject the Taliban unless we offer them the promise of a peaceful and prosperous future. And we turn now to the last word. From the trap to your table. Why does a lobster that cost $3 at the wharf, ask Ian Brown, cost 10 times as much in a restaurant? To the best of my recollection, Larry the Lobster showed up in one of Lloyd Robichaud's traps sometime between dawn and 8 a.m. on a Tuesday. My memory of the event is impaired because at the time I was either vomiting overboard or lying in the hold of the Master Rebel, Lloyd's boat. We were almost 4.5 miles out to sea on a rare, gorgeous June day. The eastern shore of Nova Scotia is a long eyebrow in the distance, and Lloyd has been saying what he often says. In the lobster racket, sooner or later you're going to get bit. He meant not just in the business sense, but on a lobster-by-lobster basis as well. The feeling had only just returned to his left hand after being nipped by a pincher claw 2 weeks earlier. In 2013, Atlantic Canada was responsible for nearly 75,000 tons, or just over half, of the almost 145,000 tons of lobster landed on the east coast of North America last year. And for the 160 fishermen in lobster fishing area 32 off the coast near Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, this year's annual 9-week lobster season, April 19th to June 20th, was breathtaking. So much lobster had been landed in Nova Scotia by the second week of June that the shore price dropped to $3.20 a pound, which is why everyone was so cranky. To a lobster enthusiast, of course, cheap lobster sounds like a good, that is, delicious thing. But it never materializes. There is a voodoo to lobster economics. What used to be a poor man's fare, the fallback meal of people too impoverished to afford anything else, is now a billion-dollar business and a universal mark of luxury, with the result that a lobster that sells for $3.20 on the wharf can cost $55 and more on restaurant plate in New York City or Toronto or Shanghai, regardless of how many lobsters are pulled from the sea. How this happens is the life story of Larry the Lobster. Like every other licensed fisherman in Area 32, Lloyd is allowed 250 traps. He and his crew of two check every trap every day, leaving at 3:20 in the pitch dark of the morning to avoid the breezy seas of the afternoon. Rocks and whistling are forbidden on the boat as it's turning against the sun while steering out of their harbor. Lobstering's superstitious business. Today starts badly. Several strings of traps produced nothing but little ones, and by the point where the boat would normally have landed 250 pounds, the crew hasn't filled a 100-pound crate. The mood on the boat grows quiet. 10 years ago, 80 pounds of lobster a day was an average catch in Area 32, and the Eastern Shore was one of the poorest places in Canada. This spring, however, most fishermen are hauling 500 pounds a day. Theories abound, all of which are true to an extent. Lobsters procreate in cycles. Climate change is warming the ocean, and the lobsters are moving north out of Maine's coastal waters. Fishermen have better technology and bigger boats. Conservation is working. But everyone knows the most important reason. The disappearance of codfish means lobsters have no natural predators. Suddenly, at 14 fathoms, the bottom gets rockier. Two keepers and a trap is all it takes to turn Lloyd's spirits. Five keepers is a great trap. In an instant, it's a good day again. By 8 a.m., the boys have hauled 300 pounds of lobster, including the aforementioned Larry. By 10:30, they're done. The trio gaffs six brimming 100-pound crates up to the dock and into the tank of a cold circulating seawater. The men then retire to a 26-by-26-foot boatside shacks they live in during the lobster season to await the shore buyer. The shore buyers in Area 32 have paid as much as $6.40 and as little as $2.75 a pound for live lobster this spring. Lloyd's daily catch has ranged from nearly 700 pounds to less than 300. If he can trap 500 pounds a day, an average 455 a pound, and can get out, weather permitting, 5 days a week for 9 weeks, he's lost as many as 21 days to weather in past years, he'll gross $102,550. If you don't gross about $91,000, Lloyd insists, you can't really call it a living. Still, as people who aren't fishermen say, that isn't bad for 9 weeks of fishing. Derek Stevens, the shore buyer at Lobster World, shows up at 1:40 p.m. to pick up Lloyd's lobsters. "Price is back up to $365, okay?" he said to Lloyd and hands him a piece of paper. 590 pounds or $2,150. By 5 p.m., Derek is back at Lobster World, having picked up 60 crates in total. The lobsters are roughly graded. She, a pound. Culls, one-clawed lobsters with other mutants. Females to be thrown back. Pound and a quarters, pound and a halves, all the way up to jumbos, 4.5 pounds and beyond. And restacked and drained through crates under spigots spouting cold seawater. This is when I get my first real look at Larry. He's a fine specimen. 2 pounds, green-black, large claws, male, and a brand new rock-hard shell, judging from the unworn spines under his tail. His chitinous carapace, or shell, which is actually his skeleton, just worn on the outside, is an eat-but-don't-be-eaten machine. He has the classic, inscrutable, pissed-off, prehistoric arthropod lobster look. I often try to imagine the moment when the first person figured out these things were ultra-edible if dropped in boiling water. For trucking and giving Larry a home for a few days, Rick Murphy, owner of Lobster World, will add 60 cents a pound to Larry's price. 2-pound Larry was worth $7.30 out of the water. Rick resells him for $8.50. Larry cools his carapace at Lobster World for 3 days until he's trucked half an hour down the road to Tanger Lobster Company Limited, a shipper on Friday. Tanger is the lobster equivalent of a spa in Palm Springs, California, one of 30-odd companies in North America that specialize in shipping premium live lobster. It's run by Stuart Lamont, a large, pink, pleasant, and voluble man who grew up wanting to be a writer but became a travel agent for lobsters instead. As the annual North American catch has nearly doubled to 150,000 tons a year over the past decade, lowering the price of lobster, Lamont has turned to Asia as his savior. China has 1.4 billion people, he will tell you, whether you ask or not. Those 1.4 billion have a huge disposition to seafood in general, and to lobster in particular. They're also used to paying $35.40 a pound for Australian rock lobster, vastly inferior, Lamont claims, to the product plucked from the Atlantic Ocean. His trick is to keep the lobster as fresh as the day it came out of the ocean for as long as possible, preferably until the season ends and prices rise. Hence the cutting-edge operation at Tanger, an intricate series of refrigerated 35 to 39 degree Fahrenheit ocean water holding tanks and high-tech packing rooms designed to keep live lobsters in a state of sluggish semi-hibernation so their shells stay hard and their eggs unreleased. Outside in the 77 degree sun, a lobster will die in an hour. But in Tanger's refrigerated slumber party conditions, they can live 6 months. Lamont can truck these bugs to New York City, Boston, Montreal, and Toronto for 23 cents a pound, and can fly them elsewhere for roughly $1.15 a pound. For these tender ministrations, Tanger adds another $1.05 a pound. 2 pound Larry is now worth $10.60. The following Monday, 6 days after being trapped by Lloyd, Larry leaves Tanger in a cardboard box with 2 ice packs and 7 other lobsters at 11 in the morning. That evening, he's put on a FedEx plane in Halifax, and by 1 a.m., Larry's sitting comfortably in a FedEx station in Toronto's East End, for which FedEx charges $1.31 a pound, bringing Larry's worth to $13.16 in total. Tomorrow morning, FedEx will deliver him to Toronto wholesaler Lorne Ralph at Seaport Merchants, who will in turn add another $1.37 a pound for delivering Larry to The Abbot, a gastropub in North Toronto. By afternoon, 2 pound Larry will be worth around $16. And so Larry the Lobster reaches the final stage of his great journey. Chris Davis owns The Abbot with his wife, Carrie McCloy, and doesn't usually serve lobster. It's too expensive. But Lorne offered him a good price, so Chris thought he'd try it as a promotion and charges $27 a plate for a 1 pound lobster. An excellent lobster dinner for $27 is a good value. I now knew, however, that the actual cost of Larry was just over $8 a pound. But that's the formula in the restaurant business. On the industry standard theory, Chris said, a third of what you sell it for is food cost. Add another third for labor and another third for overhead and profit, of which 60% is rent, taxes, heating, napkins, and the like. If Lauren had sold Chris lobsters at around $8 a pound and Chris sold them for $27 a plate, he made a little over $3 profit per meal. No wonder 9 out of 10 restaurants go broke. The voodoo of lobster economics never goes away. A chunk of tail meat on a $21 apple, truffle, and spaghetti squash salad may shout fancy to a diner, but the restaurant is making less profit than it can on steak, which isn't alive and doesn't spoil as quickly. Chris planned a 2-course meal, a butter-poached lobster crepe with ginger and pea shoots to start, and a boiled lobster later. The cost for Larry, about $55. By 6 p.m., the chef, Kevin Beal, has 3 huge pots of heavily salted water rolling with lemons and bay leaves. I watched Larry go into the pot. I waved goodbye. I am somewhat ashamed to say I felt no pang, like none. But by my count, at least 30 people had helped Larry to his demise. The meal was served at a communal table to 14 people, none of whom I knew except my wife. This is an excellent way to eat lobster. People are never shy at a lobster dinner, perhaps because you eat with your hands. Suddenly, Larry arrived at the table. He was huge and red and imposing. But then I remembered something I'd heard back at Tanger. Do not be afraid of the lobster. When I finally broke into Larry, I took my time. I had to work to crack his massive crusher claw, but the flesh was astonishing and tender. I sucked his telson dry and cracked his chest lengthwise and found mouthfuls of meat. I felt guilty and grateful all at once. For that rare sensation alone, Larry was worth the money. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Globe and Mail. Move now to the health and science page. Siberia's worrisome crater. Earlier this year, a yawning crater measuring nearly 100 feet deep in diameter mysteriously appeared in the deepest, darkest Siberia. Some conspiracy-minded Russians blamed aliens, others American missile tests. Researchers visited the site last week and believe they know what was actually behind it. And it's not good news. Air near the bottom of the crater contained unusually high concentrations of methane, up to 9.6%, archaeologist Andrei Plekhanov says. Air normally contains just 0.000179%. His team believes that as temperatures rose during the unusually hot summers in 2012 and 2013, the Siberian permafrost thawed and collapsed, releasing underground pockets of methane that erupted upwards, carving out the crater. If this happens frequently, two other craters have already been spotted in the same area, it could have a dramatic effect on global warming. Methane traps 20 times more heat in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. To confirm his findings, Plekhanov wants to study the crater more closely from inside, but that won't be easy. Its rims are slowly melting and falling into the crater, he tells the Washington Post. You can hear the ground falling. You can hear the water running. It's rather spooky. And the secret of happiness. Self-help books insist they know the secret. Psychologists spend hours trying to help people achieve it. Now scientists from the University of College London believe they have found the key to happiness. Low expectations. People who don't expect much from life, they say, are much more content and derive greater pleasure when things go well. From the study, the team scanned the brain activity of volunteers as they participated in a game. Scientists found that the degree of happiness players experienced when they won a reward depended on how much that reward matched up with their expectations. The lower the expectations, the happier they were. Neuroscientist Rob Rutledge, who led the work, said that in the real world, people with lower expectations get greater pleasure from receiving a gift, going on a vacation, or having a great meal. Happiness depends not on how well things are going, Rutledge tells the Washington Post, but whether things are going better or worse than expected. And the health scare of the week, skin cancer on the rise. Hoping to use what's left of your summer to work on your tan? America's acting Surgeon General has one word for you. Don't. In his office's first report focusing solely on skin cancer, Boris D. Lushniak called the disease a major public health problem that requires immediate action and warned of the dangers of overexposure to UV radiation. He noted there are more skin cancer cases diagnosed each year than breast, prostate, lung, and colon cancers combined. rates of melanoma, the deadliest form of the disease because of how fast it spreads, have almost tripled in the past 30 years. Lushniak, a dermatologist, said it was up to parents to teach their children about sun safety, in the same way they would about dental care or healthy eating. "We have to change the social norms around tanning," he says. "Tanned skin is damaged skin, and we need to shatter the myth that tanned skin is a sign of health." On the Talking Points page, college sports paying the, quote, amateur athlete. "Finally, someone has officially called BS on amateurism," said Sean Gregory in Time.com. In a crushing defeat for college sports governing body, federal judge Claudia Wilkin last week picked apart the NCAA's long-cherished, though clearly illogical, reasons for failing to fairly compensate college athletes. The case was sparked by an antitrust suit brought by former UCLA basketball star Ed O'Bannon and some teammates, who challenged a system in which colleges, athletic directors, and coaches reap millions while players are barred from getting anything more than a scholarship. Wilkin ruled that players should earn a cut of licensing revenues generated by the use of their name, image, and likeness in commercial products, capped at $5,000 per player per year. But by condemning the NCAA as a cartel that engages in blatant price fixing, Wilkin almost invites a future plaintiff to try to tear everything down and create a true open market for college athletes. "The NCAA has some serious flaws," says Allison Schrager in BusinessWeek.com, but paying players won't resolve them. All but seven colleges with the biggest football programs lose money on athletics, and the vast majority of student athletes do not generate big revenue. For most of them, a four-year scholarship can be worth upwards of $150,000. Not a bad deal. "The biggest concern is that many athletes spend so much time practicing and playing, they do not get an adequate education. And Wilkin's ruling will do nothing to address that." Paying some players could also run afoul of Title IX, said the federal law that guarantees gender equality in college sports, said Michael McCann in SI.com. "If schools are now compelled to pay male football players and basketball players, female athletes are likely to sue for compensation, too." "Indeed, this ruling may unleash chaos," said Ben Strauss, Steve Eder, and Mark Tracy in the New York Times. The judge bluntly dismissed the NCAA's arguments about amateurism, but the decision, which is being appealed, does not mandate that universities immediately pay players. It says only that the current rules are illegal. "Clearly, the ruling didn't go far enough," said Scott Lemieux in TheGuardian.com, "but it does establish that the NCAA's current business model is doomed. The big question now is whether the next model will be a tweak of the old one or a whole new ball game." Amazon at war with the book trade. The war of words between Amazon and publishing house Hachette is getting uglier, said Gregory Wallace in CNN.com. A full-page ad in the New York Times last week, signed by more than 900 writers, including bestsellers like Stephen King, Donna Tartt, and John Grisham, accused Amazon of harming the livelihood of the authors on whom it has built its business. The authors were protesting the online retailer's decision to block sales of books from the publisher Hachette, the home of such authors as J.K. Rowling and Stephen Colbert, in an attempt to force Hachette to lower the price of its Kindle versions. "Hachette wants to charge $15 per ebook," said Sean Carman in HuffingtonPost.com, "so it can protect authors' already diminished incomes and cover its cost. But by insisting that ebooks be priced at $10, Amazon may drive publishers out of business and create a dystopian horror in which all of literature will be replaced by the self-published novels of wingnut bloggers. Actually, Amazon is acting in the book industry's best interest, said Aaron Pressman in Yahoo.com. The company's research shows that $10 ebooks sell 1.74 times as many copies as those priced at $15. The greater number of copies sold more than offset the lower sticker price, generating more revenue for publishers and authors. Besides, publishers do not deserve more than $10 for an ebook that costs them nothing to print or distribute, said Jeffrey Dorfman in Forbes.com. As digital versions of books become ever more popular, authors will simply upload their books directly to Amazon servers. In this new world, authors will keep writing and readers reading. Whether a publisher will be in that equation is very much up in the air. What a sad day that will be, said Rosemary Gerning in the Herald. As bits and bytes continue to replace printed pages and books become dirt cheap, the incomes of authors who labor over their work for years will plummet further, just as musicians saw royalty payments dwindle when music became digitized. Instead of physical objects that can be read and treasured for generations, books will become yet another inexpensive string of zeros and ones to be quickly consumed and banished to the cloud. And a couple of notes as we wind up. Americans are going solo. We eat breakfast by ourselves 60% of the time and lunch alone 55% of the time. About 27% of all U.S. households are made up of a single person, the highest level in history, said the Census Bureau. On the poll watch, just 3% of Americans think that the U.S. is winning the war on drugs, while 84% disagree. And how about a quote from Jerry Seinfeld, quoted in GrubStreet.com? I don't watch food shows, and I don't go to strip clubs. I'm not interested in just kind of doing something. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.